You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
So, what are you guys going to do? Are you going to continue to be a bunch of soft, underperforming, tattooed millionaires?
They said all along, perfection is not possible. We just want to get the big decisions right.
What are we doing? What are we doing?
Green room getting hot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
The right answer was a goal in Times Square so we could do butts up. But that was a decent one.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental on MLSsoccer.com. As we always are, here in the green room, Andrew Wiebe, David Goss, Matt Doyle. That means it is a Monday. Here to talk MLS Week 12. Sam Stachkol coming up, going to talk Nashville's big hire, a CEO with some serious chops. Paul Tenorio talking YAM. That's what I'm calling it. This youth transfer fund, whatever. No. YAM. Has to be YAM.
Yeah. Yeah, that's better than YTF.
WTF, it's a little close to that, but that's where we're going with that. U.S. national team has a roster out, and of course, we've got the mailbag, and it is centered around pop stars that could or could not be located and trained up in MLS. But first, let's talk about Atlanta United, the saltiest fan base in Major League Soccer.
Oh, wow.
So much salt.
You know who's going to be salty about that?
Who?
Orlando City fans, because they're the saltiest.
Gotcha.
Southeast rivalry.
Is it any coincidence that the salt is coming from down south?
I don't know, man, because Montreal, when they get, you know, and they get the rains, they can be pretty salty as well. So salt can come from both directions.
I think NACL power rankings are perhaps in the works here on Extra Time Radio. Which fan bases give it out the most?
I like that he dropped the science.
That he used the periodic table.
Yeah, he memorized the periodic table, didn't he?
I probably could not hit you with, like, any other element therein, but somehow I've figured that one out. Let's talk Atlanta and New York Red Bulls, and we'll start with that. Of course, MLS Week 12, we've got the full slate that we'll hit here in the first segment. But this was the game that, I mean, it drew the eyeballs, it drew the attention, it drew controversy, it had some really good goals. There was the injury scare with Kamar Lawrence, and honestly, I'll just start there. We got an update. Seems like he's fine. He was conscious as of last night, fully responsive, in good spirits. He was stayed overnight for this observation from the staff there at the hospital, but apparently he's on his way back to the New York area with a trainer of the Red Bulls. So that's good news. Some bad news, Luis Robles' Ironman streak is over at 183 games. A knee injury kept him out, but Larry Bird came in, did what he does. Ryan Mira had a great game. And look, we've known for a long time that Ryan Mira was a good goalkeeper. We've also known that he was going to get games when he had Luis Robles in front of him. So he finally got a game, and the Red Bulls got a 3-1 win, and now Atlanta United are dealing with adversity. Adversity for the first time in a long time. I mean, they lose in the playoffs. But outside of that, it's been smooth sail, and it's been pats on the back. It's been attaboys. And now they've lost to Sporting Kansas City and to the Red Bulls at home. They drew with NYCFC, so against the elite teams in this league, they don't have a win.
Well, I mean,
you could say LAFC, but if you look at LAFC's last five, it hasn't been
great.
Yeah, they've been a little bit inconsistent. So this is a game in which Barco gets a goal, and then Danny Royer gets a PK, which, of course, we'll talk about how that happened. And then BWP does BWP things, and he's now up to 8 goals and 5 assists in less than 700 minutes. He just continues to get better and better and better in this league. And, yes, we will talk VAR and the referees. But first, I want to know what this means for the Red Bulls. Because ultimately, this is a huge road win. This is a team in Atlanta that Peter Vermes is coming out and saying after they beat him that he thinks this is the best team in the league.
Yeah.
This is right now what I would say are kind of the standard bearers for the league when it comes to talent acquisition, packing a stadium with a number of people that's unprecedented in the history of this thing. Buzz, New York Times, think pieces, best record in the league still, 25 points, 2.08 points per game. What did this mean to the Red Bulls? They now lead the league in points per game. They now look like potentially the best team in Major League Soccer.
Think back a month ago, they were coming off that 2-1 home loss to Chicago, and they had 3 of 4 on the road, really 5 of 7 on the road. And you're like, well, I guess we're going to figure out what the Red Bulls are. Are they that team that destroyed Cholos? That was a good Tijuana team that they just ripped apart in CCL. Or are they the team that dropping points at RSL, at Orlando, home to a Chicago team that hasn't been much?
Doing the same old against Chivas.
Yeah. And I mean,
and look what Toronto did after with right. this run after that,
I mean,
the league.
CCL, like, the CCL hangover is so real. We
Seattle,
see it every year.
Thing.
We're not seeing it from this Red Bulls team. They have sort of fire in their eyes, and they really understand how they want to play, and you can see it every time they win a ball at central midfield. They hit that blind 50-50 ball right into the channel, and it's not hopeless because they're just so well drilled that they have guys. As soon as that 50-50 ball is run, they're making those runs.
There's a run in there, and that run is more committed than your defensive reaction to
and
it.
They completely understand. That was the word that Tata used. He said this is the most committed team in the league in the build-up to this game. And that's how the Red Bulls are winning. And then you add the special talent around it, because BWP is the MVP now, right? He lapped Miguel Almiron last night, and he's somehow at 33 having the best season of his year, of his career. But if it's not BWP, it's maybe Kaku. Yeah.
Which is also why it's not somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing, and people are talking about, like, wow, I can't believe BWP's putting on these numbers. It's like, they brought in an elite playmaker behind him who makes his life easier and, like, sets up guys around him, and they're a better team right now than they've been over the last few years. Part of that's Kaku, and the other part of it is the center backs.
Yeah.
It's the base they build off of, and how many times on this show did we talk about Miazga and Perenel when they won Supporters Shield?
Right.
And they haven't had anything until now.
I don't want to say they haven't had anything, because I actually think that they've done some good stuff over the last couple of years. It hadn't.
Oh,
been
sorry,
at that
man. It's center back that equaled that.
Right.
Sorry.
Sure. And, what they did was all building up to this point. It was developing Aaron Long and then throwing him into the mix and saying, "Well, we've got faith in you. Make it happen." And then it was, "Okay, you know what? We've got some good options, but it's not quite at the level we want.
Right.
Let's beat down Vancouver's doors until we get Tim Parker." And by the way, they still got to re-sign Tim Parker.
Right.
Yeah. But they've kept opening up cap space and transfer money by selling guys and trading guys that everyone kept yelling at them for, to put themselves in a position
for sure.
They have flexibility as well, because what's their central midfield? Tyler Adams and Sean Davis, both guys who they developed from within, both guys who are really affordable, and both guys who just keep improving. Tyler Adams is he's as good as Diego Chara, and Diego Chara should, in my opinion, be going to the World Cup with Colombia. Yeah, you know, in terms of his ability to just make the field smaller and take just end plays that should end up being dangerous going in the other direction. So they've just checked all those boxes, and adding Kaku and developing Florian Vallot and just really understanding now in year four exactly how they want to play. I think this is the best team. I think this is the best team in the league.
So the other thing about Tyler Adams, as well as Sean Davis, just got re-signed. So you have control over him for X number of years. Tyler Adams, you're not holding on to him.
No.
This is, the rumors came out, and MLS Twitter was abuzz with this, potentially headed to RB Leipzig, which is so logical. He said on this show before, Naby Keita is the guy that I look at. Rebel Leipzig, I watch all their games. Like, it just makes sense. He's on a good deal now. When they sell him, think about that allocation money.
Yeah.
And he's a homegrown player. So they're going to get that money. They're going to get all that money. It's not even like, we're going to take this cut and figure it out from there. No, that's like, look at Maurice Adu way back in the day, and you can name all these players. That's club-changing money that comes. And we'll talk about what that might be for them. By the way, he came out in this game.
Yeah. They said he's fine.
Yeah.
They said it was precautionary, but that would be a huge hit to this team.
Jesse and took him out because Jesse wanted him to be ready for Leipzig preseason. Jesse's like, I'm going to be coaching this team in Germany. Got to have Tyler ready.
Need my boy in there. Also for him. It's a good move for him to come out. He's going to move. That's going to happen. So whether it's summer or winter or wherever, you got to preserve his legs.
And we got to say, for us, for fans of MLS, especially for fans of Red Bull, you want to keep him for the entire year. But for him, summer is so much better. Get that preseason with the team.
Especially in a World Cup year where, World Cup players are going to struggle to get moves done.
For sure.
You come into full preseason.
And going to come in with potentially heavy legs.
Right. And you come in for a full preseason ready to go. That could be big for him.
So Kaku, 9 assists, 3 goals in 9 games. BWP, 8 goals, 5 assists in less than 700 minutes. Red Bulls come out, get the big win, 3-1. But Atlanta United, as I said, the salt. I mean, they're harvesting this thing. They got mines out there. They're about to export salt because it's that bad at this point. They were not happy about Sporting Kansas City. We knew that. And then they got a laundry list in this game. Chris Pinto's the referee, Mark Geiger, which, ooh, really got in the craw of just about everybody in the five stripes, was the VAR. So it started up 1-0. Ezekiel Barco gets a goal, and you're thinking, okay.
Against the run of play.
Yeah. You're thinking typical Atlanta game, maybe. Because once
I thought the Red Bulls I thought the Red Bulls were by far the better team the first 20 minutes.
No.
Then there was about a five-minute span where Atlanta created chances, and then they scored at the end of that.
I didn't think anybody was the better team the first 20
They
minutes.
Played the entire first 20 in Atlanta's
half. Yeah, they weren't creating anything.
They were creating turnovers, which is what they wanted.
Right, but they weren't – like, Atlanta was locked in, and, like, I felt like the first 20 minutes was a 50-50.
By the way, don't care, because nobody scored a goal there. So – Barco gets his.
Because he doesn't watch the game. Didn't
Mira have those two spectacular saves?
Between the
20
and 25th minute.
No, before the Barco goal.
Yeah, I know. Those were the 5 minutes and then ended with the Barco goal.
Okay. Welcome to semantics driven by Continental here.
Just respect Larry Bird.
1-0 Atlanta. And then it looks like it's 2-0. And I'm thinking floodgates. This is what happens at Mercedes-Benz. Whether or not they play better the first 20, once they start scoring goals, they don't tend to stop. And Joseph gets a goal here in which he, on the broadcast, I think they just said was stronger than Tim Parker, basically gets him behind, easy finish, does what he does, rounds Ryan, he has no chance. Mira has no chance.
Yeah.
But then it goes to video review. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what's this going to be? These fans are going to lose their minds, and they lost their minds. But Pinto, with the help of Mark Geiger, says, no, that's a foul.
Right.
Joseph Martinez got clipped. And when you watch the replay.
Tim Parker got clipped.
Yeah, that's sorry. He clipped him. Indisputable fact that Joseph Martinez makes contact with Tim Parker.
Yeah.
Now, from there, you have two camps. One is the camp that wears black and red. One is the camp.
The Metro Stars camp?
No.
The DC United fans are rooting against
fine.
Red Bulls.
You guys are on a roll today. And the other camp is what I would call people who are logical thinkers.
Wow.
So one of those people, though.
I'm in the logical thinker camp.
But one of the people who's the logical thinkers wasn't Tim Parker.
He did not react.
He apologized to Ryan Mira.
He did not react in a way that he thought he was.
Yeah.
At least he didn't outwardly seem like he was.
No,
fouled.
He apologized to Ryan Mira as the goal got scored, which seemed to me like I messed up.
And in some ways he did, because when you watch it, it's hard to tell because he gets clipped and that starts the chain reaction of him going down. The clip knocks his foot into his other foot and then he's going down, period. Before that, it looks like he's on this ball. He's going to be the one who wins the ball. But when you watch it back,
he took a terrible angle.
You can convince yourself for sure that he's going to get rounded.
Yeah, that's the pressure that Martinez puts on every center back he plays. I think he puts the fear of God into him. But nonetheless, he fouled him. It was a foul. As well,
anybody on the other side. Anybody? Do you understand the argument being made?
By the way, I 100% understand.
Incidental contact. A lot of people want to repeat that.
Yeah.
Go control F the IFAB rulebook. You're not going to find that word.
Yeah.
I
understand Atlanta fans being upset though. One is because there's like no reaction on the field, and so they do the full celebration. I get it. Doesn't matter, but it still affects the way that you read the play. And then, two, there was no indication that there anything had happened. Like, the fact that not a single Red Bull player complained felt like the replay came out of nowhere. Then you see the replay on the broadcast, and you're like, oh, yeah, there's a bunch of contact there, which you didn't really notice in
a lot
of time.
And it's so slight, and it's not intentional. But the whole thing, careless can be interpreted a lot of ways, and that's the benchmark for a foul. So I think on the careless, in my sense, is when he cuts behind him to try to get the angle, Joseph Martinez, because that's what he does. He sees that ball's running past. It's on him to make sure that his foot pattern, that he doesn't cause the contact. Because if Joseph Martinez isn't there, Tim Parker gets to the ball. Yep. He still almost does when he gets tripped.
Yep.
So that's your measuring point.
See, then it probably would have ended there if the Red Bulls didn't get a PK.
Correct, because then Miles Robinson is called for a PK on Bradley Wright Phillips, and that's what evens the game. And
it's a soft PK.
It's charming, man.
Is it any softer than the one that was called on Christian Higuita last week?
No, probably not.
No.
No. I mean, I don't think – I'm pretty sure Atlanta fans were cool with that one.
Yeah.
They were all right.
They seemed 2-1 okay
win, you know. Yeah. We'll take that. He pushed him. Yeah. He touched his chest. You saw it. Yeah. I saw it. I thought that was a PK as well.
It was a soft penalty. Man.
It was. Look, and BWP knows what he's doing. He's not getting to the ball. It gets cleared. Miles Robinson has to be smarter. You can't wrap your arm around somebody. Benny Fellhaber came out on Twitter and he said, all we want as players is consistency. I look at every single controversial play in this league to do instant replay. I've seen a lot of consistent calls where grabbing and holding in the box has been called. There have been some outliers.
Well, the problem
for sure,
is that.
So it's not 100%.
And that thing does happen 5 times on set pieces throughout a game.
Yes.
The exact thing Miles Robinson
There's a
did.
Difference between a set piece where it's everybody in the box, you don't know who's going to get the ball, where's the ball, who has a chance at it, versus
BWP. Yeah, if you tackle someone.
But I'm not even sure Miles Robinson did that. He had his arm around his shoulder. I don't think he was actually physically yanking him back. He just had his arm wrapped around him. And it was a mistake.
It's soccer, you're not supposed to use your
I
hands.
Get it.
There's no excuse to have your arm wrapped
it.
Around
he
a player.
He paid for it. It may be soft. I think
David,
it's a
I've seen
as
you
well.
Defend.
Yeah, I'm not very good at soccer. That's why I'm sitting here right now.
So then Jeff Horenowitz got called for a red card. It obviously wasn't a red. They go to video review. He comes back on the field. It's a weird situation. A player's been sent off. The whole thing's gone crazy, and he comes back. And Brad Guzan said afterward, like, this has happened to us multiple times, and it's weird. And then BWP gets the game winner on this 2-1. What a ball
from
Michael
Mario. Can I just say, it's not weird. It's not weird. This is what VAR is for, right? Like we all know that mistakes are made in officiating. Having a guy sent off and then go to the ref
right.
being able to say, you know, I looked at it in the monitor. I trust my fourth official. I trust my, you know, video, VAR official. I'm going to admit that I made a mistake. Bring him back on. That's exactly what we want.
So I feel like Atlanta fans think that this happens too much to them, and that's kind of what Guzan's saying. But it goes to the fact that they play at a high speed. They play open games. You mentioned the fear of God from Joseph Martinez. On both sides in Atlanta games, it's chaotic. Mm-hmm. And then you get calls like this where guys are getting tackled in wide open field. Yep. There aren't really situations in some soccer games where there's even players in wide open space like that one-on-one. And in Atlanta games, it happens like 6 times a game.
Yeah.
And you've got goalkeepers 35 yards out. And so it looks weird to Atlanta fans because it happens so much to them. But I think that's the nature of the way they want to play their games.
You know what? I think we're going to have to ask Ben the Research Bear to dig into some of this and tell us which clubs have had the most instances of video review. What are the outcomes have been? I would be interested in that, certainly. And if you haven't listened to last Thursday's show, we had Mark Geiger, we had Jerry Marufo in this very green room talking about what makes a good video assistant referee, what the process is like for video review. I mean, taking you through what they were thinking in these instances. And they had another 2 plays. I mean, we're not even through with this. I mean, BWP scores the game winner, and there's a possibility that Almi Rohn is fouled earlier in the play. Atlanta aren't happy about that. I don't think that one was a foul, personally. And then Leandro Gonzalez-Perez takes down Florian Velo headed into the penalty area, and this is dog so for me.
Yeah, me too.
Like, he's taking a touch into the 18 to take a shot 1v1 with the goalkeeper. I know Greg Garza is recovering, but he's not going to get there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The contact stops it. So you got lucky there, Atlanta. Just acknowledge that. And by the way, you were not good in the second half. And then Garza sees red on, what is a red card?
Yeah.
That's like the definition of what is a red card? Boom. Show that clip. So
and
Atlanta goes
like
down.
Popped his shoulder out at the same time.
Yeah. That was tough.
That was a bad 30 seconds for Greg Garza.
Yeah, it was, man.
So Atlanta, you don't feel good about this one. I get it. It's just one game.
Yeah.
You still have the supporters' shield.
Is it, though? Because, like you just said, they just played 2 home games in a row against, you know, the best teams in the league, and they lost both of them by multiple goals. So the question is, are Atlanta United kind of like last year? I mean, we remember how great they were last year, except they didn't beat a playoff team after July. And then we remember what happened in the playoffs. They couldn't score against Columbus. So the question with Atlanta is, are they flat-track bullies? I don't think they are. I still think they're the second or third best team in the league at worst. But you have to at least consider that's a possibility with this team, because they didn't get it done against Sporting and they didn't get it done against the Red Bulls. And I know they're spending their day blaming the officiating, which is understandable because I think I would probably be pretty upset as well.
The quotes, you should go check these out. Doug Robertson over at the Capital Journal, I think it is in Atlanta, has all the quotes, and they are fiery and pointed, and Tata went in on Mark Geiger for sure, just across the board. Everybody went in, and I would be curious to see what the what the blowback on some of that might be, because some of the things they said kind of dances on the line.
MLS works getting a few thousand dollars in fights. That's,
yeah, hey, man, spend that money well. Go build some futsal courts. I'm all about that. Tyler Adams, these Rebel Leipzig rumors are heating up. If it's not Leipzig, it's probably somewhere else. How much is he worth? How much should they try to get for Tyler Adams?
I mean, Miazga went for $5
million. Yep.
And Josie went for 10.
And Josie went for 10. Strikers, we know, always go for more.
Yeah.
I think if you're the Red Bull, I mean, Jack Harrison went for what, four and a half?
Ish, yeah.
Yeah. If I'm the Red Bulls for a 19-year-old.
I think it has accelerators up to 6 on Harrison, but I don't know if they're going to hit
that. He played
that.
Like one game this year.
I would hope for 7, 7.5.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
More than Miazga, less than Josie because you mentioned the position and stuff. But for his age, his ceiling, potentially, I think you can get 7.
What is his ceiling as a D-mid?
I think it's pretty high. Mm-hmm. I think he may not always have the cleanest touch.
Yeah.
But he reads the game. He's got he's world-class athleticism and speed.
Yeah.
Which means if he can read the game, he can close plays down at any level. And he can do that for a team and cover more ground than the normal guy and allow the other two central midfielders to float.
And his passing is good as well. It's not great, but it's really good.
I also think his skill set and his kind of identity as a player are entering the market at a good time. Like, the things that he gives you are things that teams are looking for and tactically fit with a lot of people in the modern game. So he's not a player where you're like,
ooh,
crap.
The modern game.
How do we fit him in?
Cha-ching.
Where does he – do we have to make a sacrifice? Do we have to change – no, he fits into what you want from that spot positionally, and therefore will have a larger market than somebody who was maybe a little bit more of a luxury player.
And I don't know if this is what you were asking, Doyle, but I do think he should play that position. I don't think he should become a wingback.
Okay.
I think his versatility, like you're saying, is a bonus for him, especially because you start him and you need to change the game, then you can shift him somewhere. Like a lot of coaches seem to do where they like to put a central midfielder in the back line when they're being more attacking, quote-unquote, which I think is stupid, but we can continue on from there. And so that is a bonus for him, but I think he can be elite at that position.
Flip side is get him in that level. Whatever it's going to be, whatever team it's going to be, make him earn it.
Yeah.
If he's a central midfielder, he will be a central midfielder. If he can't force his way into the lineup there, he might be a right back. We'll see what happens with that. Let's hit the rest of the week and a lot to talk about. I'm going to stick with Sunday right now. Albert Elise just got up on his high horse and ran away from Johan Kappelhoff. And that meant a road win, ding, 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 for the Houston Dynamo. Chicago Fire, meanwhile, in a bad spot. And we will talk to Sam Stashkill about that. But this is my thing. Houston Dynamo could be one of the best in MLS. Could be one of the best in the Western Conference, for sure. But they're playing, man. Loss at home against Vancouver. Draw at D.C. Not at the Maryland Soccerplex, I should say. Loss home against New England. Draw at San Jose, loss at Minnesota, draw at Vancouver. Those are their non-wins this year.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not good non-wins. If you're a good team, you don't not win any of those games.
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying, and I think Houston's very much a work in progress, and I think the big step that they wanted to take this year was to be a team that could beat you in the attack by doing something more besides counterattacking. And they've done that. Now, granted, against the Fire, they were able to counterattack them all day because they were just disorganized. But they've been able to create danger consistently via possession. The problem is they haven't been able to stop anything. They're soft at the back. They give away possession and fouls at defensive midfield, and they need Juan David Cabezas back. He was low-key, sort of the cornerstone for what they did last year, and he's been out all year, and they miss him. But in the West, you can take 2, 2.5 months, maybe even 3 months, to figure all that out. And it looks like they're starting to. I still have a lot of Dynamo stock. I think they're one of the top 5 teams in the West.
You know who would be good defensively and might not mind living in Houston? Jeff Cameron.
I don't think Jeff Cameron's ever coming back to MLS.
That's not what it sounded like last week when we talked to Kaelin Carr a little bit.
Same thing here. If I might be going somewhere, I'm open to anything.
Hmm.
My agent's like, he'll go anywhere. Just tell us what you'll pay him. We promise we would not spread that around and find a better deal. That sounds like leverage.
Like, honestly, Cameron, he's 33, but he would help so much because this team, again, soft at the back, give up late goals.
I mean, that would be awesome, to be honest. I would love the move.
Yeah.
To come back to the team that you started your career with, to potentially lead them to a Western Conference championship for, what, two more years while you get yourself ingrained in the media and coaching here in the U.S., like every player, like Bocanegra did, like everyone likes to do.
The flip side is, can he get a big payday outside of MLS somewhere? Does he have that? If he can do that, I think he probably does that. Because the Houston Dynamo probably aren't going to go out and pay Jeff Cameron a ton of money, given that they're basically the lowest spending team in the league.
Yeah, they are the lowest spending team in the league. We just saw that, you know, the salary release 2-3 weeks ago. But he would fit. He would fit in a big way. And it's something that I hope they look at.
1-1 draw in Minnesota between the Loons and Sporting Kansas City. I'll keep this simple for you. Who's this result worse for?
Oh, Minnesota. You can't, like, Minnesota, they've won, what, two of their last nine games? They keep dropping points at home. I understand that the Sporting Kansas City are a really good team, and Bobby Shuttleworth had a nice day. But, like, this is... These are points that come back and kill you.
Adrian Heath had some nice spin afterwards, which, by the way, listen to what coaches say. Listen to what players say. It's always spin. There's always some element of self-serving in there. He came out and said, first thing he said on the broadcast, we just got a point against the best team in the league. Oof. I don't know, man. I think this one hurts Sporting Kansas City a little bit more in their core. Minnesota are like, hey, could have been worse. Calvo got dunked on again. But Sporting's like, you know what? We finally got a goal from Kyrie Shelton that we couldn't win a game. We've only got four goals in our last four games? I think that's what it is.
I honestly think, yeah. Yeah, four in their four games. So they that has
some of those were against a shorthanded Atlanta side?
Yep.
So
their attack has regressed to the mean. But I think looking at this, Sporting Kansas City, LAFC, Portland, Dallas, Houston are playoff teams in the West.
It's really starting to...
Yeah,
stratify.
Shake out.
It is definitely stratifying.
And then you end up with, honestly, it's seven teams competing for one spot. It's Vancouver, Minnesota, RSL, Galaxy, Quakes, Sounders, and Rapids. And it's whoever takes care of business at home is going to get that playoff spot.
You put the Rapids in there. Interesting. We'll get to that in a second. Timbers have won five straight. Samuel Armenteros had the goal of the weekend, I think, no doubt for me, like a 70-yard solo job. Walker Zimmerman... front row seats to that one.
Yeah, not great.
Just observing the entire run all the way down the field and then the shot and the finish. Like, got to throw in a challenge there sometime. But five straight, man. Five straight. And LAFC have had a little bit of a regression themselves over the last five games, as we mentioned. I saw the big question here from this weekend where Bobby basically said, mi culpa, I called this team not very good, and now maybe I'm wrong. Is this team good, Doyle?
They're getting there. They figured out some stuff defensively by going to that 4-3-2-1 after the tough start to the season. Paredes has definitely adjusted. I'm still not sold at all on Andy Polo, but when he gets his ability to get forward and make the 4-3-2-1 instead of into a 4-2-3-1, that's pretty valuable. And then the big thing was Ridgewell got hurt, and his presence had been a key for this good run for Portland. He got hurt, he came off, and then Cascante stepped in and did the job. And it wasn't the exact same job as Ridgewell because he's a little more mobile, and that freed up Diego Chara to get forward. And you saw on the Armenteros goal, one of the reasons that Zimmerman was kind of frozen was because he had to adjust for that overlapping run that Chara was making. And there aren't a lot of defensive midfielders in the league who make overlapping runs up the flank in any situation, and yet there he was. So all of that sort of worked together to give Portland a little bit more dynamism, because we saw it last month when they beat NYCFC 3-0. It was just like, let's get 11 guys behind the ball. Let's have 20% possession and just do it. And this one, it was sort of a holistic and kind of flowing approach to playing the game, and I think they're taking good steps forward. And it's kind of what I expected from, I mean, I watched Gio Savarese for 4 or 5 years with the Cosmos, and he pretty much always had that team playing good soccer, and we're starting to see that with the Timbers.
And he's also letting Blanco and Valeri and Adi have some freedom, well, especially Blanco and Valeri, and saying, I think these two guys are good enough to beat most MLS teams. And I thought Cascante was really good in this game, and I'd be surprised if he wasn't starting over the next few games to get a shot to win that job. I like how aggressive he is when balls come in, stepping forward, and then Mabiala can step behind a little bit. He got beat on the chance that led to the Armenteros goal, which, by the way, has to be pointed out. Lee Wynn and Vela slipped in Rossi for a point-blank opportunity. Yeah. Atenella makes the save, and the rebound literally leads to the Armenteros goal. So it could have been 2-1 LA at that point. He got beat on that one. He got turned. But besides that, I thought he was really good. I like what Paredes has brought, like Doyle said. And Valeri and Blanco are just really good. And so you can relax if you're on their team when you're in possession.
That second year
bounce
for Blanco. I mean, last year we were sitting on the show being like, man, what do they spend this money on? Is this another Lucas Milano? Doesn't look that way. Big win for the Portland Timbers. Big win against LAFC.
For LAFC, obviously Timbers fans are going to get mad because they say we never talk about their team, and now they beat LAFC, and now I'm going to talk about LAFC. Two things. One, I like
– didn't we just talk about the Timbers for 5 minutes?
Yeah, good.
Okay.
I like that Bob Bradley has the ability to change that team a lot. So they go down 1-0. He brings on another central midfielder. He switches to a four-man back line, but he brings on Gobert, who still gives him width because he runs so much. It doesn't lose that right side, but it brings another piece into midfield, and Atuesta is the one who helps set up the goal. That extra person just to play through and pass off of changes the game for them, and then he brings in Lee Wynn, and that's the first time I think we've seen those four with Latif, with Vela, with Rossi together.
And also Latif missed a open net in this game.
And I thought it was dangerous. I thought Lee Wynn looked asleep half the time, but helped create some opportunities.
I mean, they got to be dangerous, and they got to integrate these guys before the World Cup comes, because if you look at their list, Betashur is not going, so that's they hold on to that starter. Roland Simon is probably going to go, if I had to guess.
Yeah,
he's on the 20-man preliminary squad. Omar Gobert, a little bit more of an iffy one there, but he'll probably go. Aranha's going to go. Carlos Vela's going to go. So you need...
Also, that goal was filthy.
It is unbelievable.
It's the third time he's had it this year, right? Yeah.
What is Atenella doing stepping out on him at that point?
It doesn't
matter. He found the sliver of open space and just, like... I don't know how you hit a ball like that, where it has pace, but it also floats and it curls, and you know from minute one that it's going in. It was absolutely incredible. But Bob's got to figure it out, because they're going to have a stretch here, depending on how long these teams go. Belgium could make a run. Mexico could make a run. Waiting for the straight to the round of 16.
Yeah. I don't know, dude. If they go to the round of 16, Vela might score four goals.
Yeah, and he might be without some big-time players for a while. So that's where you look at Lee Wynn. Adama Diomande, they got to get those guys rolling, get them started, so they don't have this early start kind of spoiled by some midseason malaise.
They did ink Diomande before the transfer deadline closed, so we could see him.
We could see him soon.
Yeah,
no, he's already played.
Did he?
Yeah.
When?
He came in last week.
I think he trained for the first time last week.
No.
We'll confirm that here in a second.
This is high level expertise. Yeah,
Orlando City, two straight losses to Atlanta and to Toronto FC, other elites in the Eastern Conference. Ryan Telfer.
He hasn't played.
Was I out of my mind?
Yeah, I was out of your mind. Yeah, over here talking trash, and I was like, wait a minute, hold on.
Someone came in at center forward last week. All right, well,
get out of here.
I'm going to deal with myself.
So, Ryan Telfer, I almost call him Sebastian Telfer.
Yeah.
I've done that.
Tiger Woods,
yes.
I've done that in my head a couple of times.
Tim Bezpachinko discovered this guy in a men's league a couple years back. They sign him to Toronto FC 2, and then he scores the game winner against Orlando. Of course, no Josie Altidore in this game. Orlando back-to-back 2-1 losses, as I said, to East elite teams, and 5 of their next 7 on the road. Could we be seeing 2017 play out again in 2018? Is that a possibility? Should the very reasonable and logical fans in Orlando be concerned?
They shouldn't, because Dom Dwyer wasn't there for this one, and he's the one that makes this whole thing tick. It should be Sasha Kljestan, probably. Maybe it will be Uri Rossell later on, but right now it's Dwyer. And losing him, they lose a ton up top of just pulling defenders around, linking up play, giving that little extra energy and half chances to turn them into full chances. So he's been the most important piece, in my mind, of that 6-game winning streak. I understand it was a lot at home and a lot versus lower-quality teams. But if he's your most important player, then you can't say, oh, it's all doom and gloom if he's missing for one game. Against TFC, who's not their full squad, but they're starting to get healthy. The back line's a lot better than it was. That allows Michael Bradley to move back into midfield, which makes them look better as well. And so it's not like an embarrassing thing to go up to Toronto without your best player lose 2-1.
I thought this was their best game, Orlando City, in terms of keeping their shape. And like they had a really good second half, I thought, against Atlanta United last week, but then they played a really good, solid 90 minutes, as you guys said, down a couple of key pieces. I don't think they're going to fold like they did last year. But nonetheless, their next 2 months are brutal. They're going to have to figure out how to win against or at least get points from some of the better teams in the league. And especially when they run up against New England and Columbus, because those are the teams that they're going to be competing with for a spot in the playoffs.
David Villa Day went as planned, which is to say David Villa against Colorado Rapids at home. In some adverse conditions, probably means goals. He gets two of them in this match. NYCFC run on 4-0 winners. We could talk about how bad the Rapids are. They're bad.
Can I throw one thing out there?
They're really bad.
I'm not saying it's all on him, but like, is Tim Howard 100% the starter for this team?
No, he should not be. And it should like
the
I
first
it was,
goal's 100% on him.
I thought it was clear last year that Zach McManus had surpassed him, but the issues with Colorado go so much deeper.
Myriad and sundry.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Although, for them this weekend, RSL and San Jose were in the Are We the Worst Team in the League conversation. So,
yeah.
Colorado had a good week.
That's a three-ring circus of bad. Just terrible.
I'm gonna plug Bobby's column because he's got a big look at the Rapids coming, and I don't think it's going to be pretty.
What's good about the Rapids right now?
Nothing.
What is a
literally,
what's good?
Literally
Dominic Baggi is literally your only semi-bright shining light.
Enzo Martinez is good sometimes. That was a deep cut.
I know, for a little bit of a stretch there. Jack Price has had like a couple moments.
Yeah, there you go. Three things we've done.
And it's not like this team hasn't spent, by the way.
Yeah.
Their salary budget is I think over $10 million. They got, you know, they spend a bunch on Howard, but also Eigner.
Who's not playing. Can't
get in the 18. Gashi, who doesn't play. Their new center backs, Wilson and Tommy Smith, have looked immobile and kind of out of their depth, especially against players.
Haven't seen Yannick Bolli yet.
Well, we saw him a couple weeks back standing 3 yards offside and just holding his hand up and saying, pass me the ball. It's like, you're not even moving and you're just standing offside.
Kind of reminds me of Jan Kose this weekend.
Yes. Right? That was amazing. Mm-hmm. Boateng hasn't been a factor at all for the Rapids, and these are guys that they spent a lot of money on. And like
Marlon Harrison has regressed this year.
I mean, he got hurt, and we haven't seen him for a month and a
half. Yeah, well, being on the field is important.
Oh God, what do you mean?
Look, I don't want to.
I'm just saying,
Colorado fans have enough to be upset about. They don't have to smash the dude who's injured.
It just like for the record, the worst start in Colorado history was 7 points through 10 games, which was last year. They retooled most of the roster this year, and they have 8 points through 10 games. With their brand new coach, with all these guys that they spent a lot of money on, they're a worse defensive team by miles. I don't see a light at the end of the tunnel for Colorado.
We're going to talk Patrick Vieira here in a little bit with Paul Tenorio, so stick around for that one. San Jose is coming up in the mailbag, so fear not, San Jose fans, to say, we need you to talk about us and how bad we are. We will get to that. It's not been good. Not been good. And then I just want you guys to take a pick here. Philly RSL, 4-1 Philly against a really bad team.
Mm-hmm.
Dallas 2, Vancouver 2. Collapse from Oscar Preihausman, although I think Jimmy Maurer got fouled, although it doesn't matter because I think Jimmy Maurer didn't get fouled on Kai Kamara's goal, so... Probably deserve that too. And then Columbus winning at the death. Any of those, anything there from those three games entice you? Bork Dochkal, does he bring out the fire in your belly?
I mean, it's against RSL. And
how far? God. I still remember last year fondly.
Yeah.
Last fall.
You don't have to. You can remember our preseason show where, like, all of us picked them to win the West.
Yeah. We all thought Krylak would be a step forward. And to be fair, offensively, he can do more stuff than Luke Mulholland, but Mulholland covered a lot of Beckerman's flaws in terms of being able to cover ground. And Krylak is he's not very mobile out there. So you have those two guys who can't run, and then Danny Acosta still being in the doghouse is costing RSL goals every single week. And obviously they've had some other injuries at right back, though I actually like the Brooks Lennon experiment at right back, but that's too much. It's just too much for this team to deal with. And so you don't take a ton out of dropping 3 or 4 goals on them at home. You just don't.
It's nice to see that RSL comes in and has trouble at fullback, and a guy like Pico is like, you know what? I'm going to go after them every single time I touch
and
the
Epps,
ball.
And Epps has a good game, too.
Yep.
But so. Pico's a guy who could be a difference maker, and there's a lot of guys in this league where you're like, put your foot on the throttle and play that way for 60 or 70 minutes a game. And it feels like they don't, and you don't know if it's coaching. You don't know if it's the feel of the team and whether they don't feel comfortable. So it was nice to see that. Also, David Cohn sits on the bench all the time. That was a lot of money to pay for a bench player.
Yeah. It was. And an allocation where you don't have, and that you don't
but I didn't think
can't make moves.
I didn't think we'd end up talking about this game.
I meant Dallas.
Yeah, I meant to dismiss it.
Well, I'm going to go to break anyway, so we'll be back on the other side. Sam Stachel, Paul Tenorio.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Back now, Extra Time Radio. You know that music. That means Sam Stachel is on the line. At Sam Stachel on Twitter, Gam, Tam, and Sam. It's a Monday, so that's a little bit strange, Sam, but we've got some big news. Nashville made a huge hire. Ian Ayer is going to be their CEO. You might know his name from Liverpool. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big statement by Nashville as they kind of get ready for MLS here. The thing that I immediately thought of when I saw the announcement was Darren Eales in Atlanta. You know, it's a similar profile. Darren Eales came over from Tottenham. He had a lot of experience there as an executive. Ian Ayer, decade plus running Liverpool, you know, was involved in a ton of big deals over there, good and bad. Hired Brendan Rodgers, hired Jurgen Klopp, signed Coutinho, Firmino, Sadio Mane, a bunch of these guys that are going to be playing in the Champions League final here on Saturday. He also signed, you know, he had some misses too, but that's the point is that he's been involved in these huge deals. He knows how to get them done. He knows how to close them out. And to me, it's a really big statement of intent from Nashville that they were able to convince him to come over and lead this project. Like I said, it reminds me a lot of Atlanta hiring Darren Eales, who's been instrumental for the Five Stripes and what they've been able to do in the transfer market, and which obviously has played a huge role in what they've been able to do on the field. And I think it's a really exciting thing if you're somebody that's living in Tennessee and getting ready to support Nashville SC as they move into MLS here in the next couple of years.
What do you think it requires to be successful off the jump as an expansion side? We see LFC this year. We saw Atlanta United, but we saw the flip side in Minnesota. Like, if you are entering this league right now and you're an ownership group and you're looking at how we build our franchise, how we fund the decision makers at any given level, what seems to be important in your mind?
I mean, I think the obvious and easy answer is money, right? And the thing that I think Nashville fans should be excited about is that this move indicates that they're willing to go out and spend. I doubt Ian Ayer was a cheap hire, but even beyond that, I doubt he would take this job if he didn't receive commitment from ownership that, hey, we're going to go out and we're going to try and make a splash and we're going to go spend some money in the transfer market and we're going to go spend some money on salaries so that we can put a good team out there right from the jump. So, I mean, that's an easy answer. It's maybe an obvious answer. There are obviously a lot more things besides money that go into running a successful expansion team, but that's the starting point. And we've seen that with Atlanta, certainly, and their willingness to spend. And we've seen it with LAFC, too, and their willingness to go out and drop a ton of money on transfers for Carlos Vela and Andre Horta and Diego Rossi and the like.
As the league goes on, I think you're going to see more and more expansion teams say, we have the pick of the litter. We can model ourselves after any given number of franchises. But if we want to be at the top, there are certain ones we're going to pay more attention to than the others. FC Dallas trying to make that climb. They've hung their hat on youth development. We've begged and begged and begged for a USL team for a long time. I saw some comments out there that made it sound like maybe 2019 would be the year. What are the odds?
The odds are looking very good. Oscar Pereja came out and said last week that they would have a USL team in 2019. And I've been doing some reporting on this. And I don't know if it'll be breaking news. Depends. I'm in the middle of writing the story right now. But basically what I've been told is that there's nothing finalized yet. They're hoping to have something done in the next 30 days. But if they can get everything across the line, FC Dallas will have a USL Division III team in 2019. Now, USL D3 is a new league. It hasn't yet started. There are four teams involved already for the start next year in Madison, South Georgia, Tucson, and Greenville, South Carolina. I think I got all four of those. And it's going to be a third division. So there's slightly lower standards for the stadiums, for market size, for things that you need to do there. And for a team like FC Dallas, who really need that bridge from the academy to the first team. I mean, I talk about this a lot. You know, they've signed so many homegrown kids and not that many have really contributed in MLS because they don't really have an outlet to get the minutes. They really, really need this. And even if it's not at the Division II level where all of the MLS owned and operated USL teams are currently playing, I think just having that chance to get them games, to have a team in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I've been told they would probably play some games at Toyota Stadium. Although there's a permanent home that hasn't yet been finalized. We'll see where that ends up being if they are able to get this across the line. But just having that team will be so huge for them and will be so huge for future Kellen Acostas, Victor Ulloa's, Reggie Cannon's, Jesse Gonzalez's, to be able to go on and continue to develop and potentially make an impact with the first team.
The first question anybody's going to ask when they listen to this, I imagine, is, but why not USL? Why go D3? What's your understanding in the conversations
that
you've had?
What is USL?
Yeah, USL D3.
I get it. But you know what I mean. Why go third division and not second division?
Yeah, so I'm still doing a little bit of reporting on this, so that needs to be a little bit sussed out still. But, you know, kind of the benefits of D3 is essentially you don't have to spend as much money on stadium requirements. So that's something that we've seen here over the past couple of years. So USL moving up to Division II sanctioning, there's a whole list of requirements from U.S. Soccer that are involved with that in terms of standards. And a lot of that is stadium. So I guess going to D3, you have a little bit more flexibility in terms of where you can play, in terms of how much money you might need to spend on building a venue or leasing a venue. And for a team like FC Dallas, who, you know, you're not really using the goal of this team isn't to pack a stadium or even necessarily to win a ton of games, although that would be nice, I'm sure. The goal is to be that bridge and to get those kids that you're developing in the academy minutes. So for a team like that, you know, it makes sense, I think, to maybe save a little bit of money and do it D3. But like I said, not 100% sure on the reasoning yet. Hope to have that sorted out soon.
Are there other MLS teams in talks? Because we know what Vancouver, Montreal, and Orlando City shuttered their USL affiliates over the last couple of years. Are any of those teams in talks to maybe bring it back as a D3 team?
I'm not sure if there's anyone in talks, but it would make sense. I know Vancouver, one of the issues was the stadium and getting it up to standards. And they were playing at the University of British Columbia, and you know they didn't have control of the venue and things like that. You know, I would imagine it would make sense for a lot of these teams, you know, so we'll see how it goes. You know, the level of competition will probably be a little bit higher in Division II, certainly. So it makes sense if you're willing to spend the money and you already have the venue, like some of these teams do, to stay as well, because you get a little bit better competition as you kind of bridge that gap between the academy and the first team. But yeah, I would imagine Dallas will not be the only MLS team to get into D3 here. Whether that's next year or in the coming years.
Any idea why Dallas are playing coy with it and not like giving the scoop as like a, or not even a scoop, but like having a press conference and announcing it? Or why is this
sort of
under
the
hat?
Yeah, just because it's not done yet.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm guessing, you know, Oscar Pereira came out and said it because he's excited about it and he wants to make sure it gets across the line, maybe apply a little public pressure, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's from what I understand, it's just not finalized yet. So that's why we won't see any announcements.
But Dallas fans should actually be confident that this is going to get done for 2019.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, anything can happen in negotiations with these sorts of things, right? But yeah, if I'm a Dallas fan, I think you can go ahead and get excited.
One thing to point out, you mentioned all the people it's exciting for, but the Weston McKinney one is a big one.
Yeah,
that this gives Dallas the ability to sign players. That they don't say, hey, you're going to play in MLS right now, but they control their contractual
Emerson
status.
Heinemann as well. Like, they had two – I mean, Heinemann isn't maybe that guy anymore, but he – like, they had two of the more promising central midfield prospects of the last decade, and they weren't able to ink any either of them. If they had that FC Dallas 2 or FC Dallas 3 up and running, they could have got those guys at 14, 15, 16 years old, just like what LA Galaxy did with Efrain Alvarez, who I think is considered one of the best prospects in North America now, and controlled him and maybe been able to sell those guys at a profit,
yeah,
even if they never played a minute for the first team. So it's a good business move if you're FC Dallas, for sure.
Exactly, and they've talked about this for a long time, so it's positive to see them get it over the line because they've recognized that there's a need there, and perhaps really more than almost any other team in the league, yeah, Dallas need to have a USL team for their model to work.
If it fails, they can blame you then.
Yeah, sure.
All right. He took the responsibility. Chicago Fire, we skipped over them, Sam, but Bastian Schweinsteiger had some harsh words, and a 3-2 loss at home to the Houston Dynamo is not where you want to be. Is there a way out at this point for them? I mean, is January that crippling, the fact that they didn't get the deals done they needed to get done?
They're certainly digging themselves into a pretty big hole here. What is it, 4 losses and 7 home games? That's not good, any way you slice it. I actually think they've done a decent job of treading water, considering their roster issues and considering all the injuries they've dealt with, but I don't know that it's going to be enough. They just don't have the guys on their team right now to be able to compete in the Eastern Conference. The lineup they ran out there, no disrespect, but you know, that wasn't really a high caliber lineup. And they got a lead on Houston, and Houston were able to pick them apart, doing exactly what Houston do, getting at you on the counter and getting at you on the break. And we talk about Fernando Torres and him being a potential addition. I don't know that he really solves the problems for the Fire. I think everyone knows that they need a winger. They need a number 10. I think they could use some help at center back, and, you know, maybe even goalkeeper too. So there are a lot of holes on this team. They obviously didn't really fill many of them in the offseason. And will it be enough to get some deals over the line in July? And will they be able to tread water enough to be within striking range come when those signings integrate into the team and come into camp and start making contributions in league play? I don't know. I would guess that's going to be a tough ask, to be totally honest. So it's been obviously a disappointing start to the year in Chicago. They can still get out of it. We've seen weirder things happen in MLS, but I'm certainly not optimistic about it at this point.
Yeah, we talked about the stratification is starting, so that's what's up. At Sam Stachel on Twitter, follow him for all the news around MLS, senior writer here at MLSsoccer.com. And oh, what's that? That's Paul Tenorio's music, Sam. We got to hang up with you. We've got the other one on the phone. Let's go to that. Oh, the sweet, sweet tones that come in when Paul Tenorio is going to come on the show. At Paul Tenorio, no longer national writer for MLSsoccer.com. Am I breaking news there, Paul?
Everybody... No, it's out there now. It's out there now. The secret was there for just a few days, but we launched the site last week, The Athletic, and so it's official. Sorry, guys. I enjoyed my short amount of time. I didn't expect to be given a question like this on ETR, at least as soon as it's happened. So sad to leave MLS Soccer, but excited for the chance to grow soccer coverage in the U.S. With The Athletic.
What you don't know is that we haven't released your ITC. So, I mean, you think you're going to do all this, but mm-hmm. we still hold the cards in this negotiation.
The good thing is that means that, like, they still are looking at me as, like, this great prospect, and I'm not going to be a total flop of a signing yet, you know?
Well, you're worth more before you get sold than once you get
sold.
Yeah,
it's backup QB phenomenon there.
Exactly.
So one of the stories that you immediately hit with here for The Athletic, YAM, which is what I want to call it, what you called it was Youth Transfer Fund, which sounds much more polished. Explain to people what this is, what it means for Major League Soccer.
Well, what it is essentially, the way I look at it at least, is in a way kind of creating another young designated player spot more than it is creating a new type of allocation money. And at least that's how I've had it best explained to me. And I think the focus here is adding assets to Major League Soccer. And that is significant on several levels. One, on the fact that the league has looked at all of these younger players coming into Major League Soccer in the last few years and saying, hey, we see how this is improving our league and we want more of it. But for me, the most significant bit of news to come out of this is a league that has been, I think reticent is putting it mildly, that has been really scared of being a selling league and trying to avoid that moniker, is starting to recognize how important it's going to be to start to even out their role in the global transfer market, to sell players as much as they buy players, and to create a function where your main goal is to buy low to eventually sell high, I think is a pretty good sign that the league office is starting to get a handle on, you know, what MLS needs to grow its status within the international soccer community.
So just let's make sure that we have the particulars of the youth transfer fund sort of spelled out so that our audience knows it.
So it's $3 million that can be spent over the course of essentially 4.5 seasons by the end of the 2022 season. And that $3 million can be used on transfer fees and salary, but really it's the salary above the player's budget charge. So just like a young DP, these players will count either $150,000 against the cap or $200,000 against the cap, depending on age. Once you hit 21, you go to that $200,000 number. And so any salary spent above that cap hit is used towards the $3 million, as well as any transfer fee. And so the goal, again, is to find young players under the age of 20 when you sign them, and you have $3 million over that time frame. So I think one other thing to emphasize here is it's going to be very difficult for teams to find one player that's effective with $3 million to spend. I wouldn't expect too many teams to try to stretch it to two players. So it's not a huge impact like TAM where you're seeing four or five guys signed. This is really looking at adding maybe one to maybe two assets per team.
And this isn't for the Ezequiel Barcos and Diego Rossis and Josue Colmans of the world, because those guys were all cost much more than $3 million.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I think a much better example to use would be a Milton Valenzuela type, or if you go even further back in MLS history, not too far back, but Carlos Rivas and Brian Rochez. You know, Orlando City had to use two DP slots to sign those players. Both of them would have fit within the youth transfer fund numbers. When you look at like about $1.5 million transfer fee and $300,000 to $400,000 in salary on average over 4 years, those would have been kind of the prime examples of the types of players. And I think they illustrate the dangers of buying players young at this price range. You're not getting sure things. You're getting a lot of raw ability that you have to then develop to get the production on the field. I mean, Carlos Rivas was a guy who scored 10 goals for Deportivo Cali at the age of 19. That's pretty significant. You know, Brian Rochez was scoring a ton of goals in Honduras when Orlando City signed him. That doesn't mean they're going to translate well to MLS. So it puts a lot of pressure on the teams to get these signings right, and then some pressure on the coaches to develop these players to get them to their max ability.
If these players come in and then get sold for a bigger number, does any of that money come back to them in this pot of money, or is this a one-time use?
Yeah, so it's two ways here. So first of all, like the recent rule change with homegrown players, when you sell a player that was signed with the youth transfer fund, you keep 100% of the profit from that sale. That's significant because obviously you're trying to incentivize these teams to sell those players. Then you can take that money and you can replenish your youth transfer fund with the profits from that transfer. So there is an avenue for teams to sign multiple players under the youth transfer fund. Even if they're doing it one at a time and kind of maxing out that $3 million, they can take a sale, replenish the youth transfer fund, and add a new youth transfer fund player. And so it could become this cycle where, you know, the teams like Columbus, who I think have done a really good job of identifying players in this window of money, could be adding multiple players with the youth transfer fund over the next few years. I kind of approach this money almost like, you remember when TAM first came into the league? It was like $800,000 over three transfer windows that each team would have to use. And after one or two windows, everyone was like, oh, this is a good idea. We need way more money to make it work. And then we saw the next few rounds of TAM come into play. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the team say, hey, we like this idea. We like this concept. We're finding some players, but they're just outside of the scope. We need to bump this up to $5 million or $6 million to really make it effective. I think we'll see different iterations of the youth transfer fund come into play probably before the end of the first four-year expiration window of this announcement.
Last two little questions for me. One, can they use this money to sign homegrowns over that $250K that's already set?
They cannot use it to sign homegrowns. However, it is not limited to just international players. And what that means is, the way I've been told, at least from sources, that the rule is going to be written, is that it's for signing players outside of any MLS-affiliated teams. So academies are affiliated with MLS. There are some USL teams that are affiliated with MLS. The players from those teams can't be used. But this would potentially incentivize, for example, like San Antonio. They have an affiliation with NYCFC to potentially end that official affiliation because they have a young homegrown on their team, 16 years old, that they're developing. If he does well and starts to perform really well, San Antonio could sell that player to a team in MLS, and that team could use the youth transfer fund to make that kind of sale happen. So I think this could be potentially a game changer for USL and lower divisions in the US and Canada, but you're going to have to see those teams devote a little bit more into developing those players. And I think those would be kind of an example of a lower end youth transfer fund where maybe you could sign multiple players from USL because you're getting them on a $500,000 transfer fee or a $400,000 transfer fee and then $200,000 in salary. It becomes a little bit more doable. And that brings me to another point. There is a minimum amount of money you have to spend over the 4 years on a player. It has to be at least $500,000 of the transfer fund money utilized for them to qualify, and they can't be paid the league maximum budget charge either.
Can they trade any of this?
So the money itself cannot be traded, but players that are signed under the youth transfer fund can be traded after the end of one window. So if you sign a player in the summer window, you can trade that player when the next window opens.
All right, let's talk Patrick Vieira before we get out of here. We've avoided it, but this knee stuff just keeps heating up. And it sounds like with this deal ending at the end of this season, Paul, that there's a very real chance that NYCFC could lose their manager this summer. What's your feel for this one?
Yeah, you know, it started off as kind of it seemed like it wasn't going to happen. And I think that the information that's coming out of Europe right now is specific enough and significant enough that the buzz has picked up within the league. And people do feel like this is going to go down. And I'm very interested to see how NYCFC handles this, both in the short term and the long term. I think all of you guys would agree NYCFC is absolutely a title contender this year in Major League Soccer. They've played very well early in the season. They have a strong roster. They've done a really nice job in putting together a team that's got good depth and, you know, really nice top end talent. Who do you put in charge of this team moving forward to try to close out this season? But then what's the right fit for NYCFC going forward? I mean, Patrick Vieira has, you know, his sterling reputation as a player that I think has lifted the franchise, his ability to deal with some of the bigger names, his understanding and a willingness to, for example, last year, sit Pirlo. There aren't a lot of people that have the confidence and the green light to do that. So will NYCFC go back to that international bucket of coaches and try to look for somebody with a similar reputation? Or could they go back to the domestic pool? Didn't work out with Jason Christ, but could Caleb Porter be a target? I mean, that's a guy who's in the free agent market. I wonder if his name pops up in the coaching search. He would be available in the summer. I don't know if it'd be too much to bring in a coach from the outside that soon, but you know, that to me is the big question of what NYCFC is going to look like going forward.
What about John Wolanek? He's from the area. He's done great work down a level below.
I wonder what the Red Bulls would think about that if they requested to speak to him. I don't know how much they're looking to help out their cross-city rivals.
Do you get the sense that Wolanek would be the favorite for the Red Bulls if Jesse Marsh to Leipzig is a thing that happens?
You know, I think he absolutely is probably one of two names that are legitimately considered. I think Chris Armas has a lot of respect within that organization as well. And I think he'll be given every bit of consideration for the job. You know, it comes down to what the franchise values more, right? The head coaching experience that Wolanek has gotten down in USL and being a part of the first team and knowing the team and the players and the system that like Armas does. I always lean towards head coaching experience. I think that it's incredibly important to get reps in that main role. Maybe you could see them swap position. Maybe, you know, he goes down and Armas goes down to Red Bulls too if they go the other direction to get him some of that head coaching experience. But those would be, to me, the two candidates that would be probably the two favorites for the job.
How much would you say Tyler Adams is worth? What should the Red Bulls try to get from him? We tried to put a number on it, but I'm curious what you'd say, Paul.
That's a tough question just because of his position. And is he projected as a midfielder by the buying team, or is he projected as a right back? I think either way, when you look at his age, you look at the fact that he's already getting senior national team caps, that his amount of pro experience, when you look at the precedent of players who have come out of Major League Soccer, it's tempting to look at DeAndre Yedlin and his price tag and compare it there. The hard part is he had that World Cup experience and he did it on that big stage, and that always inflates your price. I would still expect Tyler Adams to fall in that $5 million range. I think that would be a fair valuation. And I'd be interested to see, because it's within the Red Bull structure, what kind of deal they put together, because it's all one owner and one amount of money, essentially, at the end of the day. You know, we saw, or at least heard, about the, kind of the way negotiations may have changed for Jack Harrison's price when City Football Group got into the fray. I believe they came in underneath what Stoke City was offering. So because it's Red Bull, the Red Bull organization, I wouldn't be surprised if it came in under kind of what his normal international valuation would be. But I would put him around $5 million.
Paul Tenorio, at Paul Tenorio on Twitter, now doing his thing for The Athletic. Go check him out there. With that, we're going to go to break. On the other side, the mailbag.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
For the summer, I like girls that wear Abercrombie and Fitch. I take her if I have one wish. She's been gone since that summer.
Back on Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental, into the mailbag. 401-206-0MLS is the Hot Take Hotline. Call us, text us, email us at extratime@mlssoccer.com or head over to mlssoccer.com/mailbag to get your thoughts to us that way. We got some good stuff.
Yeah,
we don't have Ben Bear. He's
no, we don't. We get Ben-specific questions.
Do we?
So I don't ask them when he's not here.
Right.
So people, feel free to let me know if you would like me to still ask them anyway. We get Bobby-specific ones a lot, too,
right,
which I like to try and hold for him, which means you've got a really good email about him that you're going to get to read on Thursday, which I won't be here for, but I'm very excited
I'm
you.
I'm excited for that as well.
Are there not a lot of emails for me?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't get specific ones either.
I think most people just go directly to trashing you on your timeline.
Oh, yeah.
Straight to Twitter.
Yeah.
There's more. It's a little more fun for them that way, I think.
I like to give them the engagement.
Yep.
Like Francisco Calvo.
Speaking of Francisco Calvo, San Jose fans are all up in the mentions of Extra Time Radio, and mine as well, saying, come on, talk about us. You ignored our entire game Wednesday about Vancouver. Actually, they're not saying anything about respect.
Oh, okay.
They're basically asking us to try to put in perspective the misery that they're currently
I was trying to tie it back to the Calvo
undertaking. Mm-hmm. It's bad. Mm-hmm. It's not good. And it's very similar to what we're talking about with the Rapids in that they retooled. They went out and got a new head coach. They did a lot of the things that seem like are on the road to improved results. And yet the results are awful.
Yeah,
3-1 losers at home to DC United.
Yeah.
In case you haven't been paying attention, DC United hasn't been winning very much.
Also,
and they ran you over.
Also, that game ended with said new coach saying the coach didn't do a very good job tonight.
Yeah.
He didn't put players in positions, and he wasn't good tactically.
Yeah.
He is
talking
coach.
About himself.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So,
do you guys want to talk about it more?
I mean. I struggle with what to say other than
they changed to 5-4-1 and they had a decent result, a good result midweek at Vancouver, even though they ended up giving up a lead. A draw on the road is still pretty good, and that was coming off the win over.
But that's where they're at. Is that like the goods are pretty goods?
Yeah,
and they're very rare. And they can only beat Minnesota United.
They weren't prepared. They weren't prepared to face a DC United team who doesn't do much that's different or special. You know, they came out and pressed high, and maybe that definitely surprised me a little bit. If you go back and you watch that Quakes game, you will who had a very like young player game, and Godoy, there was such a gap between them, and then their wide midfielders were so wide, nobody was filling it in. So there were constant 3v1s that DC was able to create. So Michael Starra was right to say, you know, my bad. He literally said my bad, and it was his bad, but it was the players as well. You could see the player, like, their body language is bad and demoralized.
What about the Vaco pass on the first goal?
I was going to say,
DP,
it's just,
you're going to play a hospital ball across the middle of the field in your own third on the ground? That's brutal.
Yeah.
Or maybe that was the second goal. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's brutal. And then you look
after
at Yule.
After it happened, everybody's just like.
And you look at Yule and Weehan, and it's like, this is the dude who's supposed to make my life easier in these tough situations where I'm trying to get my feet wet.
Right.
And this is what I get.
Right. And that's, I mean, and that is. You're right. I mean, that's more on Vaca than anyone else. But when I say Yule had a young player game, like a veteran player in that position sees as soon as that leaves Vaca's foot, it's like,
he's
this is a hospital ball. I just have to take three steps towards it and get absolutely run over. And he doesn't, right? He tries to. So, I mean, it was a combination of bad things. But you're right. Like, Vaca has.
You're a DP, dude. You're the leader of this team. You're supposed to be the best player on this team.
And it's a parade of individual and collective mistakes, too. When that ball gets turned over on Yule, everybody is asleep.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so easy to break them down. It doesn't even look like they're trying half the time. They're certainly not communicating. And if they are, I don't know what they're saying because it's not working.
Yeah.
And then you have these, like, this parade of press conferences where Florian Youngworth says that they play like children. And the head coach says, my bad, and there they are, sitting at the bottom, not even, thanks to Seattle Sounders and Colorado Rapids being nearly as bad, on 9 points from 11 games. The crazy thing is, their goal differential is just -4.
Mm-hmm. They're not getting blown out.
No, but they're not getting blown out, but they don't feel like they're truly in a lot of games, or they don't feel like they threaten teams.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. It's not like, oh, man, we barely lost, or, like, we got that draw, but, man, we were right there. No, that was not the case for this team. It's been bad. It's not been good. Let's go to something a little bit more positive here.
Yeah, 15-year-old Galaxy Academy signing Efwaan Alvarez, who you mentioned, Doyle and Seg 2, 6 goals in 3 USL games.
Nobody emailed us about this, but I just put it in here because, oh, my God.
Yeah,
I'm glad that you brought him up in the last seg.
Yeah,
I've been sending his highlights all over the place.
I mean, are you kidding me? The goals he's
awesome.
Scoring.
Yeah, that's like
David
the type
Beckham's
of player
out here liking the Instagram posts of these goals.
I think we
I don't
talked
know
about
what that
him
means, but it's
nice. We talked about him last year coming out of GA Cup. He can do things with the ball that other players don't do, and he uses his foot in so many different ways, and you're seeing that in these goals, right? Outside the foot, inside the foot, volleys with movement. Easy shots from tight angles. It's
very,
really
very much a creature of the final third at this point.
Yeah.
For people who haven't seen him, he's kind of a second striker, right? That's where he's a Carlos Vela type. He's not going to drop back into midfield a ton and conduct the game. But the thing about the Galaxy Academy is they have other guys who do that. They have Alex Mendez, who's a number 8, who plays for the USU 20s. They have Ulysses, you know, Yanez, who almost made the USU 17s. It's expected to be a big part of the U20s. He's more of a winger. So the Galaxy produced a lot of talent, and they got to figure out how to use it this time.
Dan from Pennsylvania, you're a record executive, and you have to manufacture a pop star from MLS players. Who do you choose?
There's a lot of good names in here. Depends on what
you
you're going
really
for.
You were really excited about this.
I am.
I barely understand what he's asking us.
I'm a scout.
Yeah.
I'm an A&R.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at Major League Soccer, and I'm saying, I gotta choose somebody who could be potentially a pop star.
Mm-hmm.
Who would that player be? I think Andrew Carlton's got a chance here. He's got the earring and the long hair and the highlights.
That's how
he's
this
probably
works.
Going in the boy band. Tyler Adams is going to be in that boy band. Mm-hmm. Will Trapp is probably going to be in that boy band, but he's the one that just, like, smiles a lot, and, like, you put him in the promotional material. He's like the good boy. He's the good boy.
No, Latif Blessing's that person.
Latif Blessing is a singular sensation. So Latif Blessing doesn't go into a group. Latif Blessing is the group.
I've been listening to a lot of Afropop lately, so I'm on the Latif Blessing train with Kai.
Kai does have the rock star mentality.
A Chief Commander Ebenezer Obey or you know, Fela Kuti type of stuff from like 70s, 80s Afropop. So I'm going that.
You don't have anybody out there that like jumps out to you.
I already said Latif Blessing.
So Dave and I formed a super group.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Who else is in the group?
I mean, those are their celebrations are so great. Those are the two who
yeah. Alfonso Davies could sneak in, and he'd be trained by
Chris
them.
Mueller. Mm-hmm. I think already seems like he has a feel for
Chris Mueller. Is more of a like he would have a rap career,
mm-hmm.
like a little Marky Mark.
Yeah, Asher Roth esque.
Uh huh.
That's a
yeah.
That's a
what about reference. What about like you know sort of Latin American style stuff just coming from the guys in. In Atlanta.
I was just thinking, could you put Barco and Mickey and, like, Joseph's kind of the brooding one?
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know. None of them really talk that much, so they're all kind of brooding.
Yeah, but Joseph just screams brooding.
Yeah, but Mickey doesn't really like to talk, and Barco's pretty sheepish as well. Yeah. I don't know that that would work. I think you'd have to go, like, more FC Dallas with, like, Maxi Arruti,
mm-hmm.
frontman.
Oh,
Mauro
actually,
Diaz leaves
yeah.
the band, like, 2 years in because he's actually the star, but Maxi Arruti's always talking. And then you got, like, Mosquero and Figueroa who are, like, you know, the dudes, what's it called? The guitarist from Four Seasons who,
Carlos
like, leaves, but
yeah.
don't know why they're leaving.
Is definitely the drummer.
Yeah, I like
providing
this, yeah.
rhythm.
I think we just
we're good.
Created a, like a poly Latin America boy band
yeah.
From Dallas
from 1960.
This is done.
From 1960.
If you have any
based out of Frisco, Texas.
Oh, if you have any suggestions, hit us up with any of that. What else we got?
You ready to talk about soccer again?
Yes.
Kevin from Milwaukee, gentlemen. There was a discussion on Matchday Central about whether or not Crew SC should be considered one of the elite teams in the East, and they undoubtedly should. There are usually between 3 to 5 teams each season that are clearly a cut above the rest. This year, there are 4, and all of them happen to be in the East: Red Bulls, Atlanta, NYCFC, and Columbus in that order. I'll consider Toronto when the team is fully fit. If Columbus Crew SC don't pass the eye test as an elite team, consider this. If we looked at expected goals, they're undefeated. Put another way, Columbus have produced more expected goals than their opponents in every single match this year. Guess who that source is from?
Ben
the
invalidate
himself.
All takeaways from this email.
Only 4 other teams have 3 or fewer expected losses, and 2 of them were already listed in New York Red Bulls. 2 expected losses and soon to be ranked number 1 in the power rankings, and the Houston Dynamo, 2 expected losses. This is largely because of how poor they've been at finishing. Atlanta United, 3 expected losses. FC Dallas, 3 expected losses as well. They might be the best team in the West, but 7 of their 10 matches have been at home, where they're undefeated so far. Last week, Doyle wrote something about how the Crew were entering a tough 6-game stretch, beginning on the road at New England, ending at LAFC, and they should be happy to take 7 points. After a road win in game 1, they're already almost halfway there.
Yeah, they're still in the stretch,
This is
though.
Kevin from Milwaukee,
this
by
is,
the way.
Like, I agree that the Crew play great soccer. They really understand what they want to do. Jossy Zardes has been great. The defense has been great. I think you can make an argument for Harrison Offal's Defender of the Year, and I think you did that last week, Andrew, in your in your column. Andrew writes occasionally too, by the way.
I do twice a week. Twice a week.
But their next fight, I mean, that win at New England was huge. Like, we usually don't have huge games in May. That was a huge win. Their next 5 games at Sporting Kansas City, versus Toronto, versus the Red Bulls, versus Atlanta, at LAFC. That's murder.
Yeah.
That's murder. So we will have a better idea of Columbus if Columbus can sustain this, because you're right. Expected goals matter. They really do give you an idea of how well a team is playing, but finishing is a skill. Finishing is a skill, and right now I think that if you look at Columbus's finishers as a whole, they're a cut or two below those other teams at the top level.
Bearded Jack from New Jersey. Early in the season, NYCFC were the team to beat. Then New York Red Bulls beat them. Last few weeks, Atlanta are the team to beat. The New York Red Bulls beat Atlanta. Do I even have to say it?
I thought we already said it. He just said it. I guess, no, somebody else said it. They'd be number 1 in the power rankings. But that's the way it works. Like, you beat the best teams, you assume that mantle, but it's not permanent.
Yeah, and I also, I do want to, you know, shout for NYCFC. They played by far the toughest schedule thus far. And I think now that it softens up a little bit, just a little bit.
And David Villa is healthy.
And David Villa is healthy.
Quietly 7 goals and 3 assists.
And
they've
And they've figured out some stuff in terms of backline depth. I expect NYCFC to be right there till the end.
Felix from New Brunswick, who's a big fan of the show, except when Ben is on, so he's having a good day.
We got a couple of those people recently.
Yeah, I might be a little late for Thursday's show, but it's okay. We're going to read it now. Ben Bear's recent article about who has faced the toughest schedule and TFC having the easiest one in theory, but only having 7 points, and Seattle having 8 points after having one of the toughest schedules. The comments were interesting, and Ben defending his stats by saying, Toronto have been injured and missing a lot of starters, but Seattle have missed a lot of starters too. So I sat down and did the math to see if this was true or not. I did not count sub-appearances. I counted sub-appearances as 0.5 games played and sub-appearances under 10 minutes as 0.25 of games played. So if you consider TFC starters, and he put together what are, I think we would all mainly agree, are their best 11, they've played collectively 54 games.
Do we? He has Akeche in here.
Yeah, Akeche doesn't belong anywhere near there.
Yeah, get Akeche out of that.
Okay.
He does not have Marky Delgado in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is a nonsense
demerits,
email.
Demerits, demerits, demerits.
So this is going to make his point look even better probably, but Delgado and Akeche have been healthy for the same amount of time Akeche's played less. If you say that those are their best players, they've collectively played 54 games. If you say that Seattle starters, and then he has what he considers their best 11
that
with Lierdam, Nuhu, Torres,
yeah,
and Marshall, Alonso, Roldan, Lodero, Jordan Morris, obviously, Rodriguez, and then either Ikram, Dempsey, or Svensson, who he averaged all together as one player, they've played 58.75 games. Now, if you put Delgado in over Akeche, that probably means that Toronto's players have, quote-unquote, been healthier, their starters,
for sure,
than him. He said it's pretty close together. If you doubt the math, he can send the Excel over. But he's saying that Toronto's getting a bye for being injured, while Seattle's not, and Seattle's been just as injured, if not worse.
Right, and that's he's just.
But that's because Toronto had this incredible run where they proved that when they're healthy, they're this great team, whereas Seattle have not had some run.
I am old enough to remember Toronto, when healthy, beating teams like Club America and Tigres. You know, like, we don't have to go that far back. Second of all, Seattle's good players aren't as good as Toronto's good players. It's just not. Ozzie Alonso, fully healthy, is not as good as Michael Bradley. Nicholas Lodero, fully healthy, is not as good as Sebastian Giovinco.
But those two guys haven't been missing.
Bradley and Giovinco.
Yeah.
Fair, though Bradley has been playing out of position for a month and a half, and we saw what happens when you slide him back into central midfield. Like, even the point is, even if Seattle get to full health, they're not as good as Toronto. And there are a lot of guys who are key for Seattle who are just past it. Clint Dempsey scored once in his last 15 games, and they've yet to score a goal when he's on the field.
Well, he didn't really count that.
Chad Marshall is not the player he was 2 years ago. He's just not. You can see it. Roman Torres has not, for the past 8 months, has not been the player he was before that. I understand.
Oh, by the way, Rodriguez is not as good as Vasquez.
Yes.
Ikram's not as good as Vasquez at his best.
Right.
There's just the like for likes, I mean.
But he's not saying that if Seattle's healthy, they're better than Toronto. He's saying Seattle's getting pounded while Toronto's getting a bye, while they're both missing important players. And you could say Seattle's not as good as Toronto.
Because
we
understand that Toronto's injuries aren't long-term, and that as soon as they get these guys back, they are literally one of the two best teams in North America. Literally one of the two best teams in North America. With Seattle, even if they get these guys back, they have a bunch of starters who are washed. And maybe that's enough to sneak you into the playoffs in the West, but maybe not. Like, we're talking, like, completely different stratospheres.
I'm good to end on that rant, personally. So, big thanks to Sam Stashkel, Paul Tenorio, you guys. The weird Monday game is about to begin. LA and Montreal. We'll talk about that on Thursday. Dave is going to be where?
Maryland.
Why are you in Maryland?
Because it's a state of freedom. I don't know. I'm going to babysit my girlfriend's nieces.
Nice.
Wow. Yeah. That's a step.
So that's like, you know, it's like, it's kind of like USL. And then if he's good enough, maybe he gets the call up and he can.
I'm definitely not.
Babysit camp.
Uh-huh. Because I already talked to you about that before we started this show, and the world's going to end in like 6 years.
Okay. So you're not going to.
I won't even get a chance to get there. But you're doing great,
Weeby.
Well,
Cam
is such a treat for the world.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back on Thursday.